This is Life Worlds, the place where we explore life through other eyes and minds. Let's flip the script and discover how to orient your world around nature. I'm Alexa Permanish. Come join me as we get down and forage for fungi, stalk coyotes, draft laws for rivers, hum with beehives, sing bird language, and help beavers to dam again. Let these stories spark your reconnection to nature's multiverse. Learn how to bring ecosystems back to life, become an agent for other intelligences, and begin to see how you too are the sum of all life worlds. Hi, friends. Seeds. The seeds. Memory keepers, speckled time travelers, capsules of deep earth wisdom, a mother encasing her living child, preservers of indigenous ways. As I think these words, I twirl and stroke three dried corn seeds in my left hand, rubbing my fingertips over their smooth skin, exploring the indents where once they held firm to their mother cob. I observe the mottled patterns of sienna brown and taupe blushes on their skin, their silken sheen as they catch the sunlight. What a mystery. Rowan White, an indigenous seed keeper from the Mohawk community, speaks of the intimate immensities of seeds. I feel them here, eternities in my palm. Heartbeat, expansion, contraction, pulsation. A whole field bursts out and then compresses to carry through the secrets of life once more. To control seeds is to control life, or perhaps rather, to know seeds is to know the keys to life. Existence can wait suspended in animation a seed, sometimes for over 2,000 years, just waiting for the right conditions to germinate. To be a seed, perhaps, is to experience time stretched out in ways I would struggle to comprehend. To be a seed is to hold the genetic code of turning starlight into matter, of morphing your body into soft green tips that tremble in the wind and drink fire. Of the many, many plants and trees we see around us, such as angiosperms, which are the flowering plants, the grasses, the apples, the oaks, the orchids, and gymnosperms, such as pine trees, cedars, and junipers, many, and indeed most, would not exist without the ability to propagate their seeds. And so we can very well say that our human and animal food system is almost entirely reliant on how seeds express these mysteries in harvests across the land. Throughout time, humans have migrated with seeds. There is a deep co-evolutionary relationship that exists in your bones between humans, land, ecology, and seeds. We would breed and keep the seeds that we knew would hold us through times of difficulty and those that would bring resilience to our children's bodies. Seed keepers are therefore those who collect caches of seeds to safeguard the crops that are crucial to a community's way of life. When humans forget, it is the seeds that remember. It is they who will know what has been forgotten. They know about drought, plagues, silk roads, drops of copper coins, the bite of antelope's teeth, the graving of mammoth feet that once used to roam the land. I remember once in Ticino, Switzerland, I hiked up a mountain on a glorious, glorious sepia-lit autumn day and visited an ancient grove of chestnut trees, some of the last of their kind that still live amongst us here in Europe. One of them had been hollowed out by fire many, many moons ago, but it was very much still alive, like a bamboo shoot, all green and ripe along the edges, and I crawled inside its sooted trunk, where I found to my delight a carpet of fresh chestnut seeds. I held one of those in my hand, marveling at all the information it must hold, knowledge from a time maybe even before Christ, memory of empires and religions and farming and all the trials and tribulations of the human race that could have been witnessed from this hilltop. What would this chestnut seed tell us if it could speak? If I was a seed, One of the things today I would tell the humans is this: you are losing us. Agriculture has become agri-business. Hundreds of thousands of plant varieties have been substituted by a small number of highly uniform commercial varieties. This is a time of mass genetic erosion. Almost 94% of vegetable seed varieties have been lost in the last century alone. It was the advent of hybrid seeds that spelled this downfall. These new versions of seeds can only propagate for one generation, and then they go bad, which is a profound violation of life's regenerative capacity. What does this mean? It means that farmers must go out and buy new seeds, enmeshing themselves in the perverse system of dependency on one or two global suppliers. And so, suddenly, in the 20th century, for the first time in history, a seed could be patented, could be privately owned. The control of life became privatized. We have been married, often against our will, to destructive chemicals whose use originated in warfare as explosives and nerve agents. And now our farmers and our seeds' futures are enmeshed in the balance sheets of chemicals. This loss of diverse and flourishing seed systems directly correlates with a loss of cultural identity for thousands of communities around the world. It is a direct threat to human cultural diversity. When indigenous seeds are lost or made illegal, when corporations push hybrid or patented seeds and their associated noxious chemicals, life for rural communities fractures. We're losing the seed keepers, sometimes very often to suicide. And so the freedom of seeds and resilient seed systems becomes a political act of justice on food sovereignty, on indigenous rights, and restoring power back into the hands of farmers. Seed banks need to move from museums to the farm and to the plate. And know that you too have the power, the birthright, and the joy to source and save seeds with your own hands. There are seed-saving groups somewhere right now near you, preserving these territories of life. So, how does this rich history weave into the story of today's guest? Well, let's bring this to place. Milka Chepkerer-Kuto is an anthropologist and climate and human rights activist. She is a member of the Sengwer indigenous community who primarily live in Kenya's Rift Valley, and she has become a representative for her people in defending their land rights after violent evictions from their traditional lands by the Kenya Forest Service. Milka is also coordinator of Defending Territories of Life at the ICCA Consortium and has worked at the UN in the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights. Her community is working to revitalize people-land relationships through indigenous knowledge systems, and Milka's work with the women to save and protect their ancient seeds is at the heart of some of this work. When people are torn from land, they begin to lose core social, cultural, and spiritual traditions. The desecration of sacred sites, the breakdown of traditional learning systems, the severing of ties in clan and kinship systems. As Milka speaks to this and to the experience of her community, you can feel in her spirit this visceral connection to place, story, food, culture, a weaving of seed, hand, heart, human, and forest. Milka herself is a seed, a story keeper, a culture holder, an inspirational tie between ancestral knowing and the modern world. Over to Milka. Milka, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Alexa. I'm doing very good. How are you?
I'm very good. I've been spending the last hours and days just reading about you and all of your work. And I find everything that you do just so, so deeply inspiring. How are you working to rectify all the injustices that have befallen your community, all these evictions and severance that your people have faced from the land? Milka, I don't know how you find the courage and the force to do all of the things that you do. And now it seems that you're elevating your traditional ecological knowledge systems as a foundation in how you weave back the community's fabric, social and ecological. And there's so much for us to get into. But first, I wanted to start us off by having you bring us into your world So what's it like in your ancestral lands, in the hills? I'm not going to pronounce them correctly, but the Cherangani Hills in Kenya, and in the Mbobut and Capulet forests. Please forgive my pronunciation. But if we were there with you right now, walking in the land, what would we see? What would we feel? Carry us there with you before we start.
My name is Milka Chepkorir. I like it most when people call me Tala because it's my clan name. You know, the females of the Talai clan. Our totem is the crown with a white strip on the neck. So we are associated with a lot of peace and a lot of knowledge on our lands. I come from the magnificent hills of Cherangany, and they are stretchy hills across what is called the North Rift Valley in Kenya. Very beautiful green hills with natural forests, very nice trees, tall, short, thick undergrowth in the forest. And so we have lived in these hills for time immemorial. You know, since Kenya became a colony, we then became divided into different regions of our huge hills. That is why you mentioned Capulet Forest, Mbobut Forest, Kapkanyar Forest, which are all on the stretch of the hills from which our ancestors hailed, and we still live there. So throughout the hills, it is almost the same climatic conditions and very beautiful tall trees, really nice undergrowth with climbing trees that are fruity. So we have a lot of indigenous fruits throughout our forests and we go in to eat them. We did it more when we were younger. So you could find, like, even today, small round black fruits. Find others red, very juicy, very nice. Of course, there's a lot of honey with trees and how we take care of our trees. Then there's a lot of flowers and the wild bees making honey in the holes of trees, or even our fathers and grandfathers putting up beehives. So this is also in every part of the Sengwer land, Mbobut, or Talao, or Kabolet. And we have taken honey more than anything else in our lives, I would say. Either mixing it in water to drink, the water to go to school. It's nostalgic, really, to say the least. Not forgetting the many medicinal plants that we have in our forests. And growing up, even today, we still have our parents, some of our grandmothers and grandfathers really giving us traditional our herbs boiled, and we have to drink them. Some of them very bitter, but we drink them and immediately we finish, we lick our honey. So it soothes the bitterness. And we go days, months, years without people feeling sick because we have a lot. So if you close your eyes and took yourself through our lands, then you would see the thick canopy, the nice undergrowth that people have to walk through and get fruits, and definitely the sounds of the birds and the colobus monkey and the other monkeys, you know, just screaming around, and the birds really singing. And then enjoying the fruits from up the tree. Some of them, the monkeys jumping on the tree cause the other fruits to fall down, and the children are eating under the trees. It's just a continuous circle of beautiful, beautiful benefits of what our trees and our waters and our birds and ourselves are related, you know. Super therapeutic.
I wanted to start with the land and the forest because it seems to me from what you've shared in our previous conversation that a lot of your work now is how you reweave the community back into that ecology. And so maybe you could mention, how does the traditional knowledge of your peoples relate to the forest and vice versa? And specifically, what are you doing now in the community to strengthen those ties between the land and the people?
My response would start from why are we reweaving? You know, where really did we lose it? How did we go off the track? And so why are we doing what we are doing? Is that with the history of colonization, there was displacement because the white farmers wanted huge pieces of land to grow pyrethrum, to grow maize, to grow wheat. And so because we own our land stretching all the way from the high hills of Cherangany all the way down so that we have a whole ecosystem of where we stay. So we have up in the hills where it's cold and rainy and green and beautiful. And during dry seasons, we would stay inside the hills, inside the forest. And during rainy seasons, because those places are cold and rainy and wet, then communities would come out to live in the plains and grow grains like millet and exchange grains with other communities. So with wild meat, because now our fathers coming from the forest with wild meat or with honey would come down to the communities to exchange. And we would live down the hills during wet seasons and during dry seasons, because we are a forest indigenous community. We love it in the forest and in the cold. We go back home. We go back up. So the white man took all our plains down the hill, because it was what they wanted for the monocropping of pyrethrum and maize and wheat. And so great-grandfathers had to move into the thick forest and never be able to come out when the climatic conditions are changing. So that was lost. And after the colonizer went away, those lands were given away to other communities by the first president of Kenya. And that continued. So we never had to get back our lands outside, you know, in the plains, outside the thick forests. We are tamed, or we are now called squatters, or people living in a place illegally, just because the tenure of the land changed without our knowledge. And we've lived here with the successive governments carrying on evictions and now saying, get out of this land. This is a public forest. This is a national forest reserve. So what do communities do? Pushed to change lifestyle, pushed to be able to live with others. And with that then comes a disconnection of our traditions, our connections, and our heritage to our thick forests, to our land. So communities have to struggle to fit with others, forcefully assimilated, lose our language with time, although we have not lost it like completely, lose our ways of life, not be able to enjoy our forest if we would be found in that nice imagination that I described before. We would be arrested. You are trespassing on a public land. But that is our land. Our ancestors are there. We go there to seek directions when we lack rain. We go there to pray to our God and to our ancestors when we have distresses on our land, because they are there, and that is where we know they are, in the waterfalls, in the thick forest that we have. But it is now illegal for us to be home. So with that confidence, the confidence of being indigenous and being Sengwer goes away very fast, because then there's ridicule of us when we are in school. Who are you? Who is a Sengwer? Is there people like that? You live in the forest. Oh, so you live up in the trees like monkeys. You know, so those kinds of very intimidating and demeaning attitudes from other communities. But when our forest left our hands and our care for other people, it's been deteriorating very fast. Every time the value of our land, the value of our forest is going away, because the connection of our ancestry and ourselves and the resources of the land is no longer practiced by the other people, in this case, Kenya Forest Service, who are now the custodians of public forest. So there's no care that is given to the trees like we would care for them. There's no care that is given to the birds and the bees and the monkeys like we would give to them. But with time, we are realizing that if we don't pick up and get back our mantle to take care of our land and take care of our ancestors, we will lose this forever. We will lose who we are forever. But do we want that? Of course, no. So that is why we are reweaving back our connection and our relationship to our land. Why this time? Is because it's a moment in which now Kenya is operating with the Constitution of Kenya that was passed in 2010. It's no longer new. But at least this is the moment that we have the power and our energies are collected to want to push for the implementation of the Constitution, because now at least it recognizes our ownership to our land. It recognizes the historical injustices that happened to communities like ours and others, Indigenous people, whose land was taken away from them with no justice. So we are fighting back to have our land back. And so it does not mean anything if you have a land and the relationship is gone and the values and the spiritual connection of the people and the land is gone. So we're working on both ways, claiming the legal ownership of our land, the legal custodianship of our land, and also now reviving, reviewing, reweaving our relationship with our land.
What you've shared about what occurred to your people, I don't have a response. It makes me speechless because it brings up too many emotions to even begin to name. And I'm struck by the grace and the dignity with which you speak it, because for me, it's incomprehensible to actually imagine what that entire process has been. And I'm speechless. And in that last part, you were saying, you know, we can have the legal ownership of the land, but this is nothing without the spiritual cultural practices. And the practices are nothing without, you know, having the landscape, which is part of that whole cosmology of practice. For those who are listening whose cultures have lost that connection, it may be an abstract concept that makes sense. But what does it mean to have a cultural practice that's embedded in the land? And I know that there are certain practices and projects that you mentioned to me before. One of them was planting a tree for an own breath. And then obviously there's the seeds project with the women that I think would be beautiful to speak about today. But can you bring us into that relationality and what you are all trying to reweave in order to regain that dignity of spirit and strength as a community?
I think the very basic understanding of human life and the reason for life is the assurance that you are living a meaningful life, you know? And as an Indigenous community, we so much believe in what do we live for others? You know, what do we make sure that when our time comes up, then our children and the children of our children and our very great-great-grandchildren will find and will be proud of what we did. What gives us so much pride as a community is to refer to our ancestors, you know, and our clan systems, and to say our family roots. Usually when you meet with any community leader, elder, or somebody elder, older than you, what they would ask you is, who are you? And so I can't just say my name, I am Milka Chepkorir, because they will not know who that is. You know how we introduce ourselves, Alexa? I say, I am Tala. And then they'll be like, oh, of which family? Because Tala now is a known clan. So you have mentioned a clan within the community. Of which family? And then I'll say, Kapkon. Now that's our senior great-great-great-grandfather. And then they say, Kapkon. Who in the Kapkon? So you say your father's name, but their Sengwer name, so that they know which age group, which age set, where in the family tree you come from, because you as a person, we don't introduce ourselves in singularity. I am not just me. I am me. I am my clan first. And then I am my family. So I have to refer to my father because he's the one who gave me the clan. If people don't get to know him, then you have to mention your ancestral region, because all clans had ancestral regions or a feature that that clan came from. So for me, many of us pride ourselves with a hill within the hills of Cherangany. It's called Kiptaber. So if I tell any elder, I am Kiptaber, I am the daughter of Kiptaber, that hill, then they will know which clan I come from. Or someone else says, I am so-and-so, and associate with a part of our ancestral land, then you know which clan they come from. You know which people. And that guides a lot of things within the community. It guides how you relate to each other, how you speak to each other, everything. And with that, just how we were introduced into how you introduce yourself has a huge spiritual connotation and relationship to our land. For example, Mount Kenya is a feature within Kenya, but I am not chipped up Mount Kenya because that is not my land. I am chipped up Teber because Kipteber is the hill on which my ancestors originated and lived in, and that is my clan ancestral heritage. So it goes deeper than who you are, but your spirit and the connection of your family and the connection of your ancestor and where those ancestors are and where their spirits are and where you need to go as a clan member to intercede for your ancestors. And where you have to go as clan members to do your rituals, to thank God, the Creator, to give thanks when you have abundance of honey harvest. Now, the hill that I am associated with has the crown that I told you with white neck, and that is our totem. Another clan has their totem as elephant. Another clan has their totem as buffalo. Another clan has their totem as hyena. So all of us, when we interrelate, when we intermarry, make sure that I, as a clan, take care of someone that is a hyena. So I have to literally take care of their totem as well. So say there's one that is a wild dog. If a wild dog comes around my home, I don't have to hit it and kill it. If, for example, I have a friend that's their totem is a wild dog, or someone else whose totem is a hyena. That is how we take care of wildlife in our land. So it goes beyond the actual presence of the land, but even the resources on this land. We can't mention about the trees, how much we respect the trees and the soil on our land and the water. It would take a day to describe the spiritual relationships that we have with our resources. The points at which I have felt that we have really gotten off is by adopting other ways of producing foods that has taken us away from who we are and how we relate to our land. And that's why we are starting with the seeds program and the planting of the trees. Because with the introduction of the exotic trees, there comes this notion of, let's plant eucalyptus and cypress because they grow fast and we will get money. You know, the notion of getting money out of the land, but not feeding into the land for it to be able to continuously sustain us. Still, because we have been taken away from our own ways of life by the education system, by now the economic system, because what was wrong with us just continuing to have our honey? And other communities away have the grains, have the other things that we need. And we just exchange. What was wrong with that? Why do we all have to grow maize, for example? Especially the things that do not take care of a whole ecosystem, like beekeeping. So we are back to can we make sure we plant trees, even if not just for our breath, but to make sure that we remain who we are as Sengwer, because we need that flower, that we give nectar, and that we feel the bee, and then we get the honey. And drawing that connectivity, that complete circle, is good, especially for the children, because they are the ones who are more affected.
As I hear you describe the way that you locate yourself across space and time in the land with your ancestors, I can imagine what it must be like to look out over the land and see the hill that your name comes from, that your ancestors are in. The landscape is alive, but it enlivens it so deeply by the ways that you are practicing. So one of the questions I wanted to ask you today was, you know, what is it like to be a seed keeper? And I think actually you've begun answering that through all of these other seeds of tradition and culture and belongingness that you're sharing. And I'd be curious to hear about the women that you're working with, and what is the role of the woman with the seed and the food? And why is it so important that you have these exchanges of the seeds, why you propagate and collect and share? What does that have to do with your community having that power? Power in the beautiful sense of the word, right? Not in the way it's used today. That strength, yeah. That... Yeah.
It is still power. Yeah, mm-hmm. Of course, not power in the other way. But
yeah.
How I realize it is a power is by how some communities and some people sometimes come back to us. Despite the many times that they belittle us and demean us, they still come back to us and be like, you know, the Sengwer have this, they still have these herbs, they still have this honey that is so medicinal. Let's go to them. Or come to us and say, how do you keep your land like this? How do you have old people that are so strong? Or during COVID, if nobody learned from COVID, then I would say there's nothing that you can ever learn in life. That's when we knew really that we had power. Soft rock, solid power within ourselves. And I wouldn't really describe myself as a seed keeper. I think I have just found myself in this moment in the life of my community and this moment in the cycle of humanity where there is a huge force against what is right, what is ethical, what is just to the earth, what is just to the ecosystem, and what is just to communities that, quote unquote, do not mean anything politically, socially, economically. So that push against a huge, worldly, global movement and philosophies of globalization. Oh, let's do this because this is what human beings should be doing at this moment. Oh, this is the 21st century. So I just have found myself in the middle of this, you know, and remembering who I am, remembering that I am not just me. I am my ancestors. I am an agent to pass on what I have gotten from the elders, great-grandmothers, grandmothers, and mothers, passing on knowledge to children of who you are, even when you are not on your land yet. At least make sure that you know who you are. And this is the reason as to why my focus right now at home is with the women. Because I know for sure that they have huge, huge, huge tons of knowledge about our land, about their children, about the children of their children, about everybody that they need to teach. One of the ways in which we are reviving and restoring our indigenous food systems is through the seed-saving programs that we have in our community. And these we do through the women groups in the community, since they are the nurturers of the knowledge and I'd say the libraries of our indigenous knowledge and the people who are really passing it on to the children
passing it on to the new community members joining the community through marriage or through migration. And so the women decided to join together on top of leading the indigenous-led education system where we are teaching our children on our language. We can actually practically do the seeding and keeping our seeds and regenerating our indigenous trees and our fruits and the foods that we used to grow, especially in the past. Like, we have integrated so much with other communities. Our food systems have changed over time, and so we are adapting unhealthy, environmentally unfriendly food production systems. And so the women in Kabolet are really looking at how do we work backwards towards our indigenous millet seeds, our indigenous maize seeds, which are grown in a small scale in an environmentally friendly way, our indigenous fruits and trees. And to do that, then they have been able to set aside a space to have a community seed bank where, like, really endangered seeds and seeds that are no longer as available as others are being stored, variety of beans and variety of just food-related seeds are kept and therefore exchanged with other community members whenever they have different varieties to put back into the store. And in this way, we are hoping to take care of our environment because they're grown in small scale, have good yields, takes care of the environment, are not prone to insects and attacks of diseases. So there would be no need of the insecticides that have been introduced to many large-scale farmers because of the diseases to which their crops are prone to. So growing these seeds not only enhances our indigenous food systems and restores our knowledge on our own foods, but helps us to walk back to where we are taking care of our environments and even more effectively, because then we are handling our foods. We are handling what goes into our bodies. The project in Kabolet is really a fascinating one. You see the women really coming together to appreciate and share about what their grandmothers used to do, rather than the food systems that are looking, quote-unquote, easy in the world. You know, it's processed food or it's produced food in large scales. It's easy. We can sell it. We can do this. But we're looking at how can we produce food that takes us back to our roots, that takes us back to us taking care of the land on which we are on, rather than exploiting it just for our own benefits. I'm proud of how the seeding concept has gone on. And, you know, the concept of something starting small as a millet seed to grow and produce more is what the women have adopted to say, even if we lost this and this and this, it takes just a few of us or even one person to tell us how it was and then we will propagate it. You know, just the way you propagate a seed to have more yield or more seeds. And I can't wait for when we will really know about our indigenous trees, our indigenous fruits, our indigenous foods in our own languages, and fight against this pressure that comes to us that makes our foods, our ways of life, our languages sound less important than others. And with time and the changing land use systems, there's been a bit of the losses of these indigenous fruits. And the women, through the tree planting initiative, which they came up with before the seed program, are really restoring and regenerating and making seedlings of the specific indigenous fruits that have been lost within our territory. Of course, we still have them in the larger territory in the forest, but can we have them just in our homesteads? Can we have them on the streams from which we fetch water so that the children can interact with them every day and actually be able to eat them and appreciate the names, appreciate the value that our surrounding, our land is giving to us. And the working with the youth and some elders within the community on making sure that these seeds are regenerated, that these seeds are planted, and that we are able to make lists of the names of the endangered seeds, endangered trees, endangered fruits, and translate them to English, Swahili, and Sengwer for our kids and everybody within the community to be able to know exactly what this tree is called and what the fruits are called and how important they are, and all the indigenous knowledge systems that surround them. This has been initiated by the women, but it's really going out to everybody within the community, and there's now collective work towards everything that is happening. A collective unit like we were before, like our ancestors and our great-great-grandfathers before this individualized system of food production, of everything came. We can't wait for what the future holds for us.
I mean, it seems that the relationship between extinction of language, extinction of culture, extinction of landscape, it's all linked, and now extinction of food. And I really wanted to ask you the relationship between the sort of traditional foods and how that links to the practice, maybe it's the seed saving or otherwise. Can you bring us into what that food system is like when it's practiced well and what you're bringing back? Because it's these little time capsules that exist inside of us are also the ones that exist in the land. And, you know, you have this monocropping occurring. And so there are all these parallels happening at once. And I don't think that it's obvious necessarily how like the deep, deep, deep diversity of the foods are reflected in these little seeds that also become extinct and are reflected in the women who are often the ones who are cooking and preparing these ancient recipes. And so I know we're coming up to the end of our time, and it might be a beautiful way to close our conversation, but I'd love to hear about the life story of some of these foods that your community ancestrally engages in, eats, cooks, and how you reweave that back in.
So I'd say we didn't have many foods that's cooked traditionally. We ate wild meat, which most of the time would be roasted and dipped in honey to preserve them over time, and that would be eaten. And more of eating of honey and some edible leaves and our indigenous fruits, a lot of it. So that's what we would traditionally produce mostly. But what we would do with other communities, and I think now that is the aspect that many people speak about, is how would we claim who we are without others? We wouldn't exist without others. That's why we have our neighboring communities that grow other foods. And then we would exchange with what we have so that now we had the millet to get the flour to eat what we call ugali with our meat. And we would exchange for other types of food. But again, with time, I would now focus on one of the foods that's my favorite, I would say, is honey, really. People no longer view honey as food. They just think it is a sweetener. It's an alternative to sugar. I don't look at it as a source of food that many communities depend on. And so our community, how we would do honey now, drawing a whole life cycle of our honey, is first it starts from how we take care of our trees, flowering trees. No cutting of trees, of course. Making sure that we have many of our trees really producing enough flowers. And then many bees within the ecosystem to collect the nectar. And then we would have beehives. We still have them, beehives, or even just wild honey on holes of tree trunks. And this honey is harvested two seasons in the year. And they both are different types of honey. One is more medicinal than the other, depending on which season, because there are moments of the year that the nectar is thick and more medicinal than during the rainy season, for example, when the nectar is light and not really concentrated. And so those different types of honey is stored in different ways, different containers, buried in the ground so that we take care of ourselves during famine. And so the great-grandfathers, even our fathers, would bury them down and then go scooping during famine or even just during when people needed honey or even when they needed it to preserve wild meat, because you roast the wild meat and dip it in honey and it gets preserved there. It wouldn't go bad. And then it scooped and we would drink. Like I told you, going to school during primary school, the drink we would take in the morning when people take tea and coffee and whatever they take in the morning is just honey mixed in water and sealed. And then we take that water and go to school. And we would be good. That would sustain us because of the amounts of glucose or sugar that is in that drink. And so that is how our honey is kept. But we have different trees that flower seasonally. So we have one of these trees that flowers in our region, I think, in intervals of 10 years. And it produces a very thick green honey, super medicinal. And the elders would get that honey and keep it because then they know that it is for medicinal purposes. It would stay that long period to be used within that long period because, again, that flower doesn't come as often. So that is the beautiful cycle of our honey. Why we are reviving it and how we are reviving it is just because first people think food is just the monocropped plants or everything else that is exotic and not our own things. But everything else that is exotic comes to clear the land, clear the vegetation. You have to grow potatoes, please spray this chemical, put this fertilizer. Everything that robs the land its glory kills the microorganisms. But what we want to do is turn it back and say, hey, we have been doing the opposite of taking care of our land. And who are we? We are a honey community. How do we make sure we have honey? We don't have to spray chemicals because we will kill our bees. We don't have to cut trees anymore because we need the flowers. Actually, people are getting sick with the other foods. Can we go back to our foods and not get sick? So we do not need the dispensary that is put in our community right now? People are like, yeah. So let's walk back to planting our indigenous trees because we want to return back our honey system. And Alexa, I'd like to say that this honey production system that is so known of the Sengwer because it is our way of life is not just a honey business thing. It's not just a honey talk thing. The same trees that give us the flowers for the honey are the same trees that give us our precious indigenous fruits that we eat. It's the same trees that give the birds places to sleep on. I have not seen birds making their nests on cypress and these other exotic trees and eucalyptus. Not even birds live on them. So why would we have them on our land? So let's go back to the trees that give us fruit, that give us enough air, that give us enough flowers to give us our honey. If anything, if we would ever want to grow something else, then we would grow them under the trees and make sure that we are taking care of our land as beautifully as the Creator gave it to us to take care of it, than the other relationship that looks at land as something that we need to extract from every year. Let's get this, let's sell the tree, let's plant maize, let's sell the maize, let's get money. We can't relate like that to a land that gives us life. It will deprive us that life one day, and then it will revive itself and go on.
Wow, that's so powerful. I think as a closing question, Milka, I'd love to ask you, I'll get from you afterwards places where people can find your work, write to you, support anything you're doing. So I won't do that now. It'll be in the show notes. So everyone who's listening, you know the show notes and where to find them. What would you tell people who are listening to this and they're like, I want to live like she's living? You know, there's this profound longing in our society to have this connection to land, but maybe we don't know who our grandmothers are, or there is no forest where, you know, I can go and make the honey, you know, the sacred nectar of life that you've been describing. So for people who are in an urban context or don't have their ancestry alive in the ways that you have, despite all of the challenges you face, how would you tell them to receive this gift of everything you've spoken and then bring it into their life? It's a hard question, I know, and I'm sorry, I know we're at the end, but it's an important one.
The how to do it is to recognize that humanity is one and that all of us have the responsibility given to us by the Creator to take care of what we have been created to take care of. How to welcome this to your life is to remember that nothing that came in between here makes you or validates anybody's ignorance and arrogance towards the planet and towards nature, and especially towards communities who have been taking care of their lands for everybody else. By that, I mean not anybody's education, levels of education, not anybody's placement on the planet, anywhere on the planet, not anybody's political placement or riches gives us any validation to disrespect our agency to take care of the planet. And then that is to say that you don't have to be in a forest to take care of a planet. We don't all have to come from forests. People live in the arid areas, in the Sahara. People live in the urban centers. Just take recognition of who you are and where you are and what best you can do to the planet. Let's not be drawn into this. You see the way monoculture happens? There is a mono behavior, mono ways in which we need to do things. We don't have to be the same. We don't have to be uniform. We just have to be human and relate to the earth with the dignity in which it deserves. So if you are in a system that is causing injustice to the earth and to communities that are taking care of it, then what you need to do is to call that out and not be the part of that system. That is the best way for you to know. Because again, self-evaluation tells you who you are. You know which system you are in that is not supporting the taking care of the land. You know which system you are supporting or you're contributing to that is helping multinational companies to deprive communities of their rights. You know which system you are. Say, for example, if you work in the chemical industries, especially the ones that are doing the agricultural chemicals, you know definitely what is going to happen with what you're making, introducing diseases, not just to communities that are undeserved, but to everybody. It's cancer everywhere. So whatever you're doing, take self-recognition and the spiritual awareness of who you are. And by that, I also do not mean that you have to be religious to know your spiritual connection as a being. Know your spiritual alignment and do just the right thing.
Milka, I got chills. And I think we all have more self-knowledge than is sometimes comfortable to look at in the mirror. And that dissonance can be very strong. I face it in my own life and in moments. And the way you speak just carries such potency that it goes right to the heart. So thank you. Thank you so, so deeply and profoundly. It's time for us to close. Is there any last thing you would like to say or share before we close this container?
Maybe the last thing I would say is, I know people are desperate for change, especially the few people that are trying to do the right thing and people who do not work on the other system of destruction and injustice, because the efforts are not as much as what we need. It's a few people, it's people that do not have the power that you talked about the other time, you know, that political, economic power. And so we feel desperate. Sometimes we feel overwhelmed that nothing is changing. Sometimes we feel frustrated that no change is happening. And so even with my call of just knowing your spiritual alignment and doing the right thing, please do not overwhelm yourself. I hope you find the spiritual alignment that calms you and reminds you that you're in a way helping to do the small that you're doing towards helping the planet. We all have individual accounts to do to the Creator in one way or the other. And if you take care of that, then you will live a meaningful life. And everybody has a role to do. No one has to be like, no, that's for activists. Oh, no, that's for so-and-so. It's all of us to do it. And the sooner we do it, the better. But don't get overwhelmed. Just do the much you know for sure that's all you could do. And do it again tomorrow. And do it again tomorrow. And we will get there. I believe so. We will get there.
That is so, it's so important. I shared with you yesterday, I was having a dark night of the soul myself. So thank you. I'll take that advice and I believe you. I know it to be true. Thank you from this part of the world to you and to your land and to your people. Have a beautiful, beautiful day. Thank you so much.
Have a very beautiful day. Let's go out and be good stewards of the world.
Yes. And so that was Milka speaking to us from her homelands in Kenya. As I said in the beginning of the episode, to control seeds is to control life. And there is this profound co-evolutionary relationship between humans, the land, seeds, forests, our fields, our food. I hope that following this episode, and not just the story of Milka, but of her community and of what the women and the people around her are trying to resuscitate, that this loss of cultural practices, of roots, of being torn apart from one's homeland can also lead to a process of reconciliation and return to the land, which must involve in some way our relationship to place. And if we're looking at place, we're looking at seeds, so often forgotten. As Milka says, it does not mean anything if you have a land and the relationship is gone, and the values and the spiritual connection of the people and the land is gone. So how do we bring something that has become a commodity from being sacred to a commodity and now back again into the sacred? Could we contemplate rituals around the world with seeds being at the center yet again? What can you do? Well, the show notes point us towards the way. There are organizations to join, courses to take. Day by day, you can call out the injustices and begin participating in these parallel systems of exchange, of reciprocity, of connection to other humans and to place through what we grow and how we grow it. It can even start very simply by thinking of your favorite foods and asking yourself, what do their seeds look like? Quick Google search and you might be astounded by what your carrots or broccoli or pineapple, wherever you may find yourself, out of what this beautiful bounty emerged from and will return to again. So that's it for me for this episode. Next week, I am speaking with a very special guest and we will be journeying up the stalk of life from seeds to plants, and exploring the realm of plant sentience and plant intelligence. We'll be learning some of the astounding scientific discoveries about what our plant friends out there are actually seeing and perceiving. So, wishing you a wonderful day and hopefully a newfound connection to these little time capsules of life that are everywhere around us. Thank you.